Welcome to the Animal Voices Show here on 100.5 FM Co-op Radio CFRO, broadcasting live in Vancouver on unceded Coast Salish territories. Today is Friday, June 13th, 2014. I'm one of your hosts, Cynthia Ganatra, and I'm joined here today by my other hosts, Jackie McIntosh.
Hello.
And our guest co-host, Darren Chang.
Hi.
Alana is also helping us out on controls. Alyssa, Jenny, Allison, Tim are away today. So welcome everyone to the show. Animal Voices is Western Canada's only radio program dedicated to animal advocacy and compassionate living, broadcasting live every Friday from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And we're also available as a podcast after airing on our website, animalvoices.org. I'm really excited about today's show. We're going to be focusing on the humane meat myth. We have two great interviews. Our first interview is with local Vancouver activist Darren Chang, who also is guest co-hosting today. Darren recently attended the Direct Action Everywhere Convergence that was held in California last month. Direct Action Everywhere, or DXE, is a direct action network of ordinary people formed using the model of grassroots networks and history of social justice. DXE's campaign, It's Not Food, It's Violence, targets Chipotle for their humane washing campaigns. At the convergence, DXE organizers from around the world got together to hear about the ideas that led to the development of DXE. They shared best practices for effective activism, and they got to know each other and build community within the movement. That interview is in about 15 minutes, so stay tuned for that. In our feature interview, we speak to Robert Grillo, who is the founder of Free for Harm. Free for Harm is a nonprofit animal rescue education and advocacy organization. They excel on online activism by building a committed online community, publishing content that serves activists as well as the general public. Robert and his colleagues at Free from Harm have written some amazing blogs, many of which specifically talk about humane and happy meat myths. And that interview is in about half an hour, so stay tuned for that. So this last weekend, I attended the Vancouver Veg Expo. It was held at the Convention Center in Vancouver on Sunday, June 8th, from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. And to be honest, when I first heard about it, I was a bit reluctant to go because there was this really large focus on GMOs and not very much focus on any animal rights movement. And it was called the largest vegan and vegetarian event, and so I was a bit hesitant, and it was quite expensive for local organizations to attend. It was about $500 for a booth, and so a lot of the smaller vegan groups and also businesses weren't able to attend. However, I did go. We got some free media passes, which was kind of nice, but we didn't have a booth there, which was not nice, but I actually had a really good time. I have issues with the event, but it was a consumer event, so they had a lot of vegan and vegetarian, but actually mainly vegan products, so I did a lot of sampling. I ate a lot of yummy treats, and I got a free full box of veganic cereal, which was pretty awesome, but I'm hoping next year they have more of an animal rights, at least a speaker. Of course, Liberation BC and Mercy for Animals were there, and so Darren, you were there. I saw you dressed up as a cow.
Yeah, so I was there volunteering with Liberation BC, just doing tabling, and we actually had a really good time there because it was such a consumerist event. A lot of people who showed up were really ready to spend money, and as a nonprofit, we actually had a really good day out there. So lots of DVDs, t-shirts, buttons, yeah, all sorts of things.
Yeah, that's great. That's awesome. Hopefully we can get a table there next year. Maybe we can get a discount, a nonprofit rate. And then also that day, there was a great anti-pipelines rally, which I wasn't able to attend, but Jackie, you and Darren went. What was that about?
No, it was great. It was a huge group leaving from Sunset Beach and just marching over to Vanity Park. Yeah, so that was really great. And there was like a wide variety of groups of people. There was a lot of people with paper salmon, and they had signs saying who will speak up for us and things like that. So it was a really great event. Darren, what did you think?
Yeah, I thought it was excellent. It's such a timely event, especially given that the Conservative government is ready to announce their decision any day now about whether the Enbridge pipeline is going to go through. So there was, I felt there was really sense of urgency for this rally and a march. So we marched across Burrard Bridge and we had a rally at Vanier Park. And I also really liked the fact that it was the march was organized by Indigenous leadership, and it's such an important thing for us as settlers to understand our roles within this community, to assist them as allies to protect the land that they have such a strong relationship with traditionally, historically. And yeah, that's great.
And then also this week was the Vancouver Aquarium protest. It was the Vancouver Aquarium's opening gala for their large donors, and we were all at that event as well. I think we did a pretty good job.
Yeah, it was a pretty, it's been a pretty busy week, it seems like. I didn't really realize that until you mentioned all the events. But yeah, on Tuesday, June 10th, about 150 activists showed up to the Vancouver Aquarium. It didn't seem like that many when I was there, but apparently there was 150, which is crazy, to disrupt the opening gala, which is basically a celebration for all their longtime donors who have donated, you know, millions of dollars to the Vancouver Aquarium. It's just basically was their own celebration on the opening and expansion of the new tank. And so we were there just to disrupt them and tell them that we are not in, we are in opposition of the keeping of cetaceans at the Vancouver Aquarium.
Yeah, and I thought we did a really good job of that. I couldn't imagine having a good time at that gala when you could hear us all chanting from all different angles because we're all in different locations around the aquarium.
Yeah, I think we definitely ruined that party for them, which is, in my opinion, a really good thing to show them that there is such strong public opposition to giving money to an institution that perpetuates animal exploitation and keeping sentient creatures in captivity and confinement their whole lives.
Yeah, and you also went this morning back to the Vancouver Aquarium, Darren, for the opening.
Yeah, so today is actually the official grand opening of the aquarium, and they had a ribbon cutting ceremony outside right in front of the entrance, which was fortunate for us because six activists showed up, including myself, and we were able to get really close to the actual ceremony, and we chanted, we disrupted, we shouted that facts that we thought people should understand. And someone actually, after the ceremony, came out and told us that we have completely ruined the ribbon-cutting ceremony because it was so loud. Yeah. And we had a great time.
Awesome.
It was very productive.
Perfect.
Between June 20th and July 1st, the 29th annual Vancouver International Jazz Festival electrifies the city with great sounds from around the world. For 12 music-filled days, 1,800 artists take to the major theaters, public plazas, outdoor stages, and nightclubs of Vancouver. From the free downtown jazz weekend on the grounds of the Vancouver Art Gallery and Robson Square, to performance works on Granville Island, from hip bistros like the Ironworks, to great concert halls like the Orpheum Theater and the Vogue Theater, jazz of all styles and stripes, blues, funk, soul, Latin, fusion, and world beat sounds will resonate throughout the city. Bobby McFerrin, Cassandra Wilson, Charles Lloyd, Maceo Parker, Jill Barber, Christian McBride, Jason Marsalis, Nels Klein, and Arturo Sandoval are just a few of the many great artists appearing. The Vancouver International Jazz Festival, June 20th to July 1st. For ticket and artist information, visit vanjazzfest.ca.
Hi, welcome back to Animal Voices on Co-op Radio. Now we have some time to talk about upcoming events related to animal rights and animal liberation. On Tuesday, June 17th, there is a fundraiser at Graze for EarthSafe, where 20% of the bill is donated to EarthSafe. So for those of you who don't know, EarthSafe is an organization that provides a lot of very valuable resources to assist people who want to become vegan, and they also have a lot of information on why we should go vegan and issues with the industries that exploit animals.
Directory. It's great. Yeah. I use it to eat out almost whenever I go out. I look at the veg directory and find where is vegan and also vegan friendly.
Yeah, and for those of you who are interested in social justice issues, this is also on Tuesday, June 17th at 6:30 at the YWCA Hotel. There is going to be a roundtable discussion on migrant justice issues. And more specifically, we're going to be discussing a policy on temporary foreign workers and questionable laws around that. And for those of you who are interested on going on a road trip to Portland,
everybody's always interested going to Portland, especially if you're vegan.
Yep. On June, between June 27th to June 29th, it's the second annual Resistance Ecology Conference is happening in Portland, and the conference is free for everyone to go. And for those of you who don't know, Resistance Ecology is a conference that is focused around eco-justice issues and animal liberation, and they have a very strong focus on movement building and coalition building across different movements. And this year it looks like they have an incredible line of speakers. So looking forward to that event.
Are you going to that, Darren?
Yeah, so I will be going on a short road trip down to Portland and with just some friends. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
And did you go to the one last year?
No, but if you are interested in watching some videos of the talks from last year, you can find them online, and I watched a few, and it looked like it was a really good event. Yeah. So I'm quite excited for this year.
Great. Awesome. And there's also some of the weekly events. We have the Chicken Vigils, which are every Friday morning at Hastings and Commercial Street outside the Hallmark Slaughterhouse from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m., hosted by Liberation BC. And were you there this morning, Jackie?
I was not often. Oh, I haven't been going that often lately because I work mostly. But there's also the weekly Brooklyn Clothing Demos, which takes place from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at Brooklyn Clothing, which is in Yale Town. It's just basically people speaking out against the cruel practice of the fur trim jackets that they saw there in the winter and trying to ask them to basically adopt a fur-free policy for the next year. Well, not basically. That's what we're asking them to do, and that's what they will do.
Great. And
to plug one more event here, still a ways away, on July 2nd, some activists from the Bay Area who organizes with Direct Action Everywhere will be visiting Vancouver. And for the few days that they're in Vancouver, we will be having some events, including a discussion on animal liberation and the work that DXE has done, as well as some organized protests and demonstrations. So more details on that as we get closer to those dates.
Perfect. So yeah, if you have any animal-friendly events and you'd like us to air them here on Animal Voices, please contact us at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com, or you can post it on our Facebook, Animal Voices Vancouver. And so our first interview is with our local activist who's here with us today, Darren Chang, who attended the Direct Action Everywhere Convergence in California. Thanks so much for being on the show today, Darren, and for also helping us.
Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. So can you tell us just first of all how and why you got involved in animal rights?
So long story short, I was actually exposed to a lot of, I guess, just realities of animal cruelty when I was growing up, because my parents were religious, and it was like a combination of, I guess, Buddhism and Taoism, and they believed in karma and doing like no harm to other beings because that's bad karma. So I was exposed to like animal cruelty videos, and I think that definitely had an impact on me. But it wasn't until that I was in university and I took a class on issues related to animal justice that I realized that this is a political issue that we can actually take actions and to help the animals.
Awesome. Perfect. And so you recently attended a convergence held by Direct Action Everywhere, DXE. I interviewed Wayne from DXE a few months ago, so you can actually find that podcast on animalvoices.org. It was a great interview. And for those listeners who haven't heard of Direct Action Everywhere, can you tell us a bit about the organization and what a convergence is?
Yeah, so Direct Action Everywhere is a grassroots activist network, and their mission is to empower activists to take strong and confident action when wherever animals are being denigrated, enslaved, or killed, and to create a world where animal liberation can become a reality. They like to use creative nonviolent tactics, so different creative protests, to tell the stories of animals, Yeah, so their aim is really focused around community building and movement building, and to create a much stronger animal liberation movement. So a convergence, I'd say it's kind of like a mini conference, but it's different from a conference in the sense that at a convergence, usually most of the people who attend are already agreeing with each other on many, you know, issues. Like philosophically, we're pretty much all on the same page. And it's really a place to share ideas, to network with other activists, and to share experiences and knowledge, and to really empower each other and to empower the movement in general, and to also, you know, prepare for future actions. Yeah.
Great. So tell us a little bit about the actual convergence. How long was it? Where were the people from who attended, and what kind of workshops?
Yeah, so the convergence itself was 4 days. It took place from between May 22nd to 25th. And people came from various cities in the U.S., and six activists, including myself, went there from Vancouver, obviously. So since Direct Action Everywhere have started their campaign against Chipotle back in, I think, November, I might be wrong, they've managed to get, I think, over 40 cities now around the world to participate in their monthly Day of Action. To speak out against speciesism and to fight for animals' liberation.
And just quickly, just for our listeners who don't know, why are they specifically targeting Chipotle?
So Chipotle is really brilliant with their marketing strategy, which is they rely heavily on promoting their products as humane and ethical, when we know as animal rights activists and animal liberationists that there is no humane way to kill someone who does not want to die. So we target Chipotle because they offer us a really good platform to dismantle the humane myth that there is a way to that we can humanely exploit animals and do violence to them. So the people who attended came from, there was an activist from Chicago, from Phoenix, from Los Angeles, so all over the place, and it was great to meet so many activists, and most of them were from the Bay Area, and that's really exciting for them because it looks like they have a strong community there right now.
That's great. And so, yeah, what kind of workshops were put on?
So for the workshops, we started by talking about why animal liberation is important as a, you know, general introduction, and why we should participate more in the type of action that Direct Action Everywhere I guess practices and participates regularly, which is to speak out strongly and confidently on behalf of animals and to disrupt spaces that normalize violence against animals, like inside restaurants that serve the flesh of the animals. And then there were workshops on leadership. So emergent leadership was a big topic about how to empower other activists within your communities to take leadership. And also, how do we, I guess, keep leadership in check. So really keep our own ego in check. And that's very important when you're trying to organize with in a structure that if you want to be more horizontal and make sure everybody's voices are heard and respected when decisions are being made. So those were all really important topics. Basically, just ideas about how to organize more effectively. And then we also talked about intersectionality and whether it's possible to work across different movements and why that is important. And social media and using social media and mainstream media to amplify our message and get a greater reach to a broader audience. And yeah, so that's the gist of it, is workshops like that.
Sounds like an amazing event and a lot of interesting workshops. And then you also yourself put on a workshop, which I will post on our website blog after the show, but and also on our Facebook. But can you tell us a little bit about the workshop that you put on?
Yeah, so it wasn't part of the convergence. It was on a separate day. And yeah, DXE was kind enough to offer me the opportunity to discuss. It's really kind of more my own interests and my own kind of academic work. And it was a paper I wrote called Creating Space and Building Solidarity with Lab Rats. And the paper basically analyzes the scientific experiments with rats that a couple of my colleagues at UBC have done, and I talked about why their work is relevant to the animal liberation movement and what we can learn from them. And the gist of it is that they had a very interdependent relationship with the researchers had a really strong interdependent relationship with the rats they were working with. And I think animal liberationists can learn from that, that when we're in the animal liberation struggle, it's not just that the animals are the ones who are always voiceless and weak and they're the ones depending on us, but we as activists, we actually depend on those animals and we need their presence when we go out and do protests and try to change the world for them.
Kind of like working in solidarity with the animals.
Yep. Yeah, for sure. And yeah, so that was basically an open meeting. So Direct Action Everywhere, they do these regular open meetings where activists can just show up to the DXE house, which is where the key organizers are living, and they have a really nice living room space and a big TV where people can do presentations to share knowledge about areas that they're, I guess, just more knowledgeable of. And yeah, it's great.
So yeah, the DXE house, I find that really cool. Like all the how many people live in the DXE house?
There are actually 8 people who live at the DXE house, and there are 4 humans, 2 dogs, and 2 cats.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, and it's just a really nice space. It's kind of hard to describe, but when you're there, you just feel that it's a very welcoming space and a very safe space for activists to be in. I remember arriving in Oakland the very first day, and one of the activists I went to the Bay Area with, Almira, we showed up, and Kelly, one of the actors who's living at the DXE house, just immediately offered to, you know, cook us food, and, you know, yeah, it was great.
Yeah, community seems to be a really big part of DXE. So obviously you felt this sense of community while you were there. What other ways do they have? I kind of saw on Facebook that they have dinners together or other events. I think I saw maybe you went on a sanctuary visit. Is that?
Yeah, so they do regularly put on community events just to get the activists to know each other much better and just have that sense of a stronger social bond. And one thing that was really helpful was the fact that they did have this community space at the DXE house, and that's definitely a really valuable lesson I learned visiting Oakland. It was that it's important, in order to create a strong community, we do need a community space where it's accessible to everybody, where important discussions can be had, and yeah, and generally I think folks were just really welcoming and friendly.
Vancouver needs something like that. Perhaps we should get a house together and we can all live there and have an open space. That would be amazing.
Yep.
Cool. And then I also saw, because I clearly was Facebook stalking you guys during this trip, because I really wanted to go, but unfortunately I wasn't able to make it. But I saw that there was also some actions as well. Were there some actions you just decided on doing?
Yeah, so the actions were definitely part of the convergence. And on the very first day, we planned an action where we went into a humane washing restaurant, and we just basically went in holding signs and disrupted while people were sitting down eating food. And this is a restaurant that really promotes like the locavore movement and sourcing their dead animal flesh from, you know, humane farms. So that is why we picked it as a target, and an activist did a speak out. I think there were at least like 30 to 40 of us. We were all in the restaurant together, and then we chanted outside of the restaurant. And then after that, we went to the Animal Care Committee office of, so it's the Animal Care Committee of UC Berkeley, and that is where all the decisions are made on how many animals are going to be used in scientific experiments. So we protested right by their building, which just also happened to be beside a fairly busy subway station entrance, and we did a die-in where basically all the activists just fell down and pretend like they're dead, and that's really just an action in solidarity with the animals that we're fighting with.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and then the second day we did a demonstration outside Chipotle. It's an ongoing demonstration called for the demonstration is called "What is Chipotle Hiding?" So we all wore these kind of creepy white masks where it's got like a bit of a blood stain around the mouth, and we all held signs saying "What is Chipotle hiding?" And we took over the road. So there were two cars that helped us like block the road, and the activists just took over the road. And a lot of it's a high like pedestrian traffic area, so a lot of people were walking by, and they were actually the reactions were quite amazing. They were all asking like, "What is Chipotle hiding? Please tell us." Yeah, and then we do that for a few minutes, and then we all move off the road and onto the sidewalk outside of Chipotle, and then we start chanting and explaining to people what is Chipotle hiding, which is violence and animal cruelty, which is, you know, hidden behind all the humane advertising. Mm-hmm. And on the third day, we did the same thing, but in San Francisco and the waterfront area where there are lots of tourists. So it was really good exposure. And on that day, there was also a banner drop, which, you know, I love banner drops. It's really exciting. Yeah, a banner drop right above the entrance of Chipotle at that location. And we also went to, I was kind of bummed out that I missed Empty the Tanks in Vancouver. It looked like it was such an amazing event, but fortunately, because Empty the Tanks is an international event and they also had things planned in California. So, many activists in the area went to Six Flags in Vallejo, and we also did an Empty the Tanks demonstration there. So Six Flags keep a lot of animals in captivity, including dolphins and elephants, tigers. Yeah. So
wow, because they're an amusement park, like rides park. And things like that. I didn't even realize that. That's horrible. Wow, that sounds like a lot of stuff. Sounds like you guys were very busy. Those are a lot of actions to pack into a few days. We just have a couple minutes left here. So what was your favorite part, if you could kind of pick?
I think the favorite part for me was definitely, just speaking for myself, I'm actually not too much of a tourist, but I did enjoy doing all the tourism stuff, but it was exciting to just meet all the activists and listen to their ideas and just have conversations with people and just realizing that there are so many people out there who share similar values with you, and it just gives you more confidence and empowers you so much more to keep on doing activism and supporting each other.
Awesome. Yeah. Cool. Thanks so much, Darren. That sounds like a great trip. Hopefully we'll try to make it next year.
Yeah, I'd like to make it next time.
Yeah, so, you know, anytime you want to go, their house is open. They're always welcome, you know.
Awesome.
Yeah. That's great. Awesome. Thank you so much.
And in the news this week, 8 employees at Canada's largest dairy farm are being accused of viciously beating cows after undercover video was given to the BCSPCA. The footage from nonprofit group Mercy for Animals Canada showed the employees using chains, canes, rakes, and their booted feet and their fists to viciously whip, punch, kick, and beat the dairy cows, including downed and trapped cows who could not escape the abuse. After an investigation, the BCSPCA is recommending animal cruelty charges against the workers from Chilliwack Cattle Sales, which has more than 3,500 animals in the Fraser Valley community, which is about 100 kilometers east of Vancouver. The company said in a statement that the employees have been suspended. In 2009, a Canadian code of practice for the care and handling of dairy cattle was published, but third-party inspections have not followed up on whether or not the requirements are being met, nor have the codes outlines been adopted into provincial law, which, you know, it's kind of an important note about the fact that these codes of practice, I mean, they're kind of self-regulated in the industry, and they're just really guidelines. They're not law. So that's important to remember. And I find, like, investigations like this can be really great to get the word out about animal abuse. That is, you know, it's part of the industry. It's not just rampant. It is part of the industry. It is the industry. My main issue, however, is, like, the fact that this seems to target that one dairy producer. And I've seen lots of claims from people boycotting Dairyland, Saputo Dairyland. But not very few are calling for a boycott of dairy entirely, except for vegans, of course. And I've also seen petitions going around asking Saputo Dairyland to stop abusing animals, which is pretty insane, considering that's, even without kicking or beating, like, that's still a pretty, extremely abusive industry. Like, babies are taken away from their mothers, and, like, females are repeatedly impregnated against their will. Like, that's abuse, straight up. I just wanted to hear what your guys' thoughts are on that.
Yeah, and for me too, that the news articles like to target the 8 people who abuse these animals instead of talking about how this is industry practice. Like every time MFA goes undercover, they always find something, because if you go into any farm, you're going to find something. So targeting the employees is not, you know, and then targeting the businesses. Okay. And then of course we need to really just target the whole industry.
Yeah, for sure. And I was not surprised to see the dairy industry and the owner of the farm to very quickly, and even the mainstream media to very quickly try to frame the issue as just like a rare incident. Mm-hmm. And when Mercy for Animals actually do their investigations by randomly picking farms to investigate. So this could have been anywhere, and it probably is happening like all over the place.
Yeah, it is. I mean, they've done so many investigations and they find this everywhere. And like, what are the charges really going to accomplish? Like, these people are likely trained this way, or at least told to be the as most efficient as they can in whatever way possible. And these animals, the main problem here is these animals are seen as nothing more than profit generators. And that's basically the way they get treated. They're machines to them, and that's how they get treated, unfortunately. So really, yeah, this is an issue that needs to, like you mentioned, targeting the whole industry rather than these few individuals who, you know, were working for a job they probably did not enjoy. And in other news, killer whale, Springer, and calf spotted in Inside Passage. So whale researchers in the Fitzhugh Sound of British Columbia's north coast spotted killer whale Springer this week with her 1.5-year-old calf. Springer, for those of you that don't know, is a member of the A4 pod of northern resident killer whales. She made headlines in 2002 when she was orphaned as a 2-year-old and spotted sick and alone near Seattle, hundreds of kilometers from home. Springer was the first killer whale to be rescued, rehabilitated, and then released back into the wild, and said last summer a research technician from the Vancouver Aquarium Marine Mammal Rescue Program also spotted Springer with her calf while conducting an animal photo survey of the whales. This week's sighting is more significant because it not only indicates Springer's good health, but shows her calf has survived the most challenging period of any whale's life, the first year. And so it appears this news kind of tells us it is very possible to rehabilitate and release cetaceans. After all, ironically done by the Marine Mammal Rescue, which is associated with the Vancouver Aquarium, who like to claim that their rescued cetaceans are unreleasable. And I say rescued with air quotes. and another Vancouver Aquarium news. The Vancouver Aquarium said that it believes its existence is at stakes as the Vancouver Park Board reacts to the election year pressure to ban the keeping of whales and dolphins. An unscheduled review of its whale keeping operations ordered by the city's Vision Vancouver majority is due to report in late July, and the head of aquarium said he believes the park board may bring in new restrictions that may put an end to the Vancouver aquarium or deeply risk its life, as he says. We're so upset about that.
Yeah, it's great that things are happening, they're changing and they're happening. Awesome. So you're listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO Cooperative Radio in Vancouver on unceded Coast Salish territories. Our feature interview today is with Robert Grillo, who is the founder of Free From Harm. Hello, Robert, and welcome to the show. Hello.
Thank you
so much for being here. So I first wanted to ask you...
I'm very happy to be here.
Awesome, great. So how did you get involved in animal rights? And also, why did you start Free From Harm?
Well, I started Free From Harm in 2009 as a way of kind of getting involved and using the skills that I had leveraged from my professional life, which is branding and design and website work. So it was a natural progression for me to take those skills and apply them to my advocacy work and create a website that, you know, I had pretty small expectations for in the beginning, but then as things developed over time, you know, months and years, it really seemed to be a site that was building momentum and building a following. So I poured more energy and time and resources into it, and it's going pretty strong today.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about Free From Harm and the work you do, your website, and the rescue stuff you do.
Sure. So, first of all, Free From Harm seeks to build a strong case to end animal exploitation, as well as build a strong base of support for this movement. And we do that through rescue, and not tons of rescues, but enough rescues where we can accurately tell the story of each individual animal through stories and photo galleries and video coverage, videos, educational videos, and really promote those so that people can get to know the animals on an individual level and then understand the broader context in which that particular animal exists, you know, the farming industry. So rescue is one aspect of how we carry out that mission. And then the other one is, of course, connected with that, the online activism, which, we're very active on Facebook. We have around 64,000, 65,000 fans so far, and seems to be, growing all the time. So we do a lot of online promotion, and then I also do some speaking events, which I'm trying to do more of. So those are the three key areas for us.
Yeah, that's great. I really like your blogs, and many of your blogs focus on the kind of happy and humane meat myth, and you've also written a lot of the blogs yourself. You have yourself and other authors as well. In one of your blogs, you talk about the happy chicken farmer fantasy, because so many people are obviously moving towards this now, free-ranged, happy, organic meat and eggs. So what do you say about this fantasy?
Did you ask me what's wrong with that fantasy?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, okay. Let's start, way back from, and before we even think about, free range and all these catchphrases that are used to try to create these feel-good messages and visuals for us. I mean, if we really think about where chickens come from, chickens originate from the tropical rainforest, where they explore the forest floor by day and then they fly up in tree branches at night to sleep. So they live in these defined territories and with a highly structured social hierarchy, which protects them from predation. And since they've been around for millions of years prior to our capturing and domesticating them, they've evolved over millions of years, and they've done quite well in this rainforest setting prior to our intervention. So a farm is not at all a natural environment for chickens. So the whole idea of pasture-raised chickens is kind of a, if you really think about it, it's a really crazy idea because it's so far removed from their natural habitat, which is the rainforest. And not only do they feel psychologically stressed by the openness of a pasture, but they're completely vulnerable to predator attacks. So leaving them unattended on a farm operation, like it's considered pasture raised, which many farms do, they lose a lot of their birds to predators. And that's partly why their prices are so much higher to offset the higher casualty rate. So, you talk to any pasture raised farmer and they'll tell you that, they're easy targets and they're always getting attacked. And, of course, with their overgrown genetically manipulated bodies, the Cornish rock hen, which is the same breed that's used by factory farms and large industrial farms, they're using the same breed because they plump up in 6 to 7 weeks and they're ready for slaughter. And these birds are just, you probably know, they have, their bodies are prone to all kinds of problems, musculoskeletal problems, weak hearts, weak livers that can collapse on them at any time. Their mobility is severely compromised, so their chance of getting away from a predator in a situation like this in a pasture setting is next to nothing.
Yeah, it's interesting how people say it's their natural. Oh, sorry. I was just saying it's interesting how people say it's their natural environment, where obviously these open pastures are not their natural environments.
Exactly. I mean, all of the combination of things that I just talked about, the way we bred them, the way we manipulated their bodies, and the kind of pasture settings that even the best case scenario, a pasture setting like this, all of these things sometimes we make them helplessly dependent on us.
And also the fact
that they're independent.
Mm-hmm. And also the fact that they're killed at the end. And so there's that fact that, you know, often they don't show on
the
packaging.
Right, you mentioned this. Exactly.
And so I actually learned a lot about eggs through some of your blogs. And so can you talk a little bit about how the chickens have been bred to produce so many eggs?
Sure, yeah. Well, first I think that one of the things that I recently wrote was a piece about backyard chickens. And you know, there's a lot of discussions. I think if you go on Facebook or blogs, you'll see there are a lot of discussions about people that are raising chickens in backyard settings or homesteads, and how much they love their chickens, and what a symbiotic relationship they have with their hens or their neighbor's hens or whatever the case is, right?
Mm-hmm.
But first, I think when we look at the situation, we should first recognize that any animal that's bred for specific traits, that is to, you know, increase the production of their eggs or secretions or flesh, they're commonly going to suffer from life-threatening diseases or even premature death as a result of that breeding. So in the case of these chickens that are bred for unnatural egg laying, they're of course no exception. And, you know, we have plenty of evidence now that even from the egg industry sources itself, and also through documenting the care and treatment and diseases in our own rescues, we have plenty of evidence to indicate this. So then, you know, once you can see how these birds suffer from their breeding, then you can easily see how gaining some kind of pleasure or benefit from the source of their suffering is immoral, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you know, if we were to rescue a dog that was in dog fighting, for example, we would find it objectionable then to say, well, you know, hey, he's trained and bred to fight, so in exchange for us adopting him, what if we, you know, make a little money on the side to earn his keep, and we let him fight and we put place bets on him, or maybe we hire him out at night to, you know, be a security dog at some place that could potentially put him in a dangerous situation. We would never do that, right? We would say, my goodness, after all this dog has been through, let's try to make his life as pleasurable as possible and safe as possible. So, we do this for the dog, but then when it comes to chickens, all of a sudden, we see things differently. But even if we're not the direct cause of the chicken suffering, in the case of the chickens that lay eggs, if we're eating their eggs, we're still benefiting from what harms them, right? Which is their rigged reproduction, which would not even be possible without the industrial scale genetic mutilation and breeding practices, which we already claim to oppose on the grounds that they're horrifically cruel, and the hatcheries where they come from. That's some of the worst practices in animal agriculture.
Yeah, definitely. I think most people forget that even the backyard chickens, they come from hatcheries where these male chicks are ground up alive. So what do you say to people who say, because obviously you have rescues yourself, correct? Rescue chickens?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so what do you say to people, because obviously you don't eat the eggs, so people who say you're wasting the eggs?
Right. Yeah, that's a really interesting phenomenon that I've come across a lot. And I think the whole idea of wasting is predicated on the idea that the eggs are ours and not theirs. So we just have this kind of assumption that that they belong to us and that, you know, we need to do something with them, because if we leave them alone, then they're going to waste. But actually, other animals might find them and eat them or something. But even if you, whatever the case is, even if they do lay eggs and you don't collect them, just the only reason why we think it's wasteful is because they're chicken eggs. And that's because our culture tells us that chicken eggs are edible. But if they were the eggs of another species, like a robin, or a turtle, or an ostrich, or, you know, some people eat ostrich eggs, but most people don't. But if they're the eggs of other species, we would, not knowing that they were fertile or not, we would never just feel compelled to collect them and say, boy, we better, collect these and eat them. Or they're going to go to waste, So it's really just a function of our culture that makes us think that it's wasteful not to eat the chicken eggs. And there's other things that we could do with them.
Yeah, and so what are the other things that you can do with the eggs?
Yeah, well, some sanctuaries, first of all, it's important to remind people that the window of egg laying for chickens is a very brief window of their lives, and it's very taxing on their bodies. So it's one of the reasons why they will die much younger than their counterparts in the wild would live. They'll end up, most of them will die of some complication due to egg laying. So their window of laying is brief and relative to their lifespan. And so it's important to know that you only have eggs for a certain amount of time. But then when you have those eggs, you can hard boil them and you can grind up the shells. The shells provide a lot of good minerals and obviously calcium, because that's what the shell is based upon, is calcium. So you're giving that back to the hens, giving them back some of that calcium that was leached from their bones to create all those egg shells. And then you can hard boil the eggs and you could, chop those up or just throw them out and let them have a feast on those. Sounds strange to some people to let them eat their own eggs, but they're infertile and it gives them back some of the nutrients that they lost.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Yeah, I've heard of many people who rescue chickens doing that as well. So obviously in the animal rights movement, sometimes there's the animal welfare groups who support this humane eggs or humane meat. What do you think about that kind of movement towards promoting these humane, free-range, organic, happy stuff?
Yeah, sure. There's so many different things to consider, and I think we probably won't have time to get into all of these, but we've put a lot of thought into this and food from harm and how, what our position is on this. But there's a few things that we could look at, and the first thing is that I think we should recognize just how biased and euphemistic is the use of the term humane in the context of applying it to the animals used in agriculture. And then we should recognize how inconsistent we are as a culture in applying this term to what it means in cases of, say, companion animals or human beings. And I think what we'll find is that the definition of what is considered humane for farmed animals is predicated on a prejudicial belief, quite frankly. It's this kind of misguided belief that places pigs, chickens, turkeys, and cows below cats and dogs and horses and humans. In fact, practices that we consider torture for humans and dogs and cats are being touted as humane when they're used on farm animals, which is truly Orwellian. So, we're using this kind of anthropocentric construct. We're using this hierarchy, like a rigid hierarchy, to define how we should treat farm animals in relation to other animals and ourselves. So it's really just a prejudice. It's a prejudice because it's based not on who those animals really are, but instead on how we want to exploit them as economic resources. And I think the next thing we should question is whether these so-called humane standards themselves used in agriculture are even real, are even genuine. Because upon closer examination, I think what you'll find is that the similarities to conventional farming far outweigh the differences. So to emphasize the differences when they're really quite marginal, this is where false marketing comes in. Right? So what happens with that is we measure against the worst-case scenario of so-called factory farming or industrial farming. Well, anything looks better next to that. So, what if instead of measuring against, say, the worst-case scenario, we measured against the best-case scenario, and we learned about what truly constitutes a human relationship with another animal by looking at how farmed animals and their caretakers interact in sanctuaries. Another thing we should question is the inherent contradiction in claiming to care about an animal's well-being while they're during the short life that we allow them to live, and at the same time advocating that he or she be killed in his youth for products we have no biological need to consume. Mm-hmm. In other words, how can their treatment matter but not their very life? How can their very life be worth less than our momentary taste sensations? So, you know, it just doesn't make sense.
Definitely.
Another thing is, you know, it could be argued that the so-called humane farming slaughter movement represents an even greater betrayal to animals than industrial agriculture. The former, the humane or alternative movement, they take the time to develop a caring and trusting relationship with these animals. They treat them with kindness and respect, or at least they claim to, and they sometimes even name the animals. And the animals respond in kind. They often bond with their human owners, and they become affectionate. So subjecting an animal that has had this kind of relationship with us to a violent end for nothing more than a cheaply priced commodity is really the ultimate betrayal. It's a betrayal not just of the animal, but also our sense of fairness and respect for others.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point you make. I really like that last point about the ultimate betrayal, because, yeah, you often see kind of in the locavore movement of people, naming their farm animals and then eating them for dinner. It's just a bizarre concept that something is once almost a companion and then becomes dinner. It's very bizarre.
Yeah, certainly.
So on to a little bit more of a happier note. We only have a couple minutes left here, but I know that you do some rescue. So do you have a little rescue story that you wanted to tell us?
You know, I'm not sure that would necessarily be a happier story.
Oh, no. Okay, any rescue story then.
I'm sorry to disappoint you, but, you know, when I look at the rescues, they're all extremely challenging, and they're extremely rewarding, too. And they're extremely good learning experiences, because each individual that we rescue comes from a whole different set of circumstances and has a whole different set of health issues some have only lived with us for like 30 to 60 days. Like, we've rescued Cornish rat chickens, hens that were bred for meat, and a couple of them we rescued actually escaped slaughterhouses and were found wandering city streets. And we got calls from the city animal control, and were able to rescue them. But then, you know, they get to us, and they've been through all this, and they finally have a safe, loving place to live, and then 30 days later, their hearts give out. They have a heart attack because their bodies can't support, you know, their hearts can't support their bodies. They're still babies, and their bodies are already, you know, adult. So, it's, you know, even if you just take it each day at a time with these animals, and you try to do what you can for them. And, you know, we've gotten some criticism from people saying that, we shouldn't be putting those kind of resources into animals that are, you know, have such a poor rate of, or chance of recovery. But in my mind, you know, since chickens represent, you know, almost 95% of the animals that we exploit, we certainly do need to tell their stories, and we need to rescue them and do whatever we can, all the more reason.
Definitely. I definitely agree with you, and I'm sure it must be hard but like you said, rewarding with the chickens that you get to rescue. I thank you so much for being on the show today, Robert. That was great. If you want to learn more about Free for Harm and how you can get involved, you can visit freeforharm.org. Thank you again for being on the show. I hope to talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. Bye.
You've been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver in unceded Coast Salish territories. Please join us next week. That's June 20th for another great show. And if you enjoyed our show and you want to keep connected to us, you can do so by our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. And you can also send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. Or check out our website, animalvoices.org, where our podcasts and blogs can be downloaded from. We are closing the show with my best, You've Got Time by Regina Spektor. Stay tuned now for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices, and please remember to be kind to the animals.
Is different.